everyone, and welcome to another episode of Building Better. Today we have the honor of having David, that is a local architect here in San Diego City, and he can help builders navigate through housing policy to activate state incentives that increase the density of the projects. So thank you for joining us, David.
Thank you, Gabe. It's a pleasure to be here.
A good place to start is me and you have been talking for some time about how we can come up with some pre-designed models to help clients expedite their project timeline by reducing the amount of time spent in that design and engineering phase. Mm-hmm. So they can, you know, have already a design that we can see if it fits into their lots, and we can start evaluating, and if it does, it really skips for them like a couple months in design, so they can go right into city submittals and mm-hmm. start mm-hmm. working on those projects. So maybe we can talk about, you know, those three versions of designing we've talked about, you know, which is the fully pre-designed models, the modified pre-designed models, and the full custom design models.
Yeah, absolutely. So any property, any development project has so many different variables, and the way we look at each property is through a specific lens of what the zoning criteria is, what the client's trying to achieve, what the construction method is. But we always strive to go towards things that are repeatable, so they're scalable, they offer ways to save some time and some money on a project. So the three ways in which we look at that is there's pre-designed options. So these are projects, designs that we've designed, engineered, permitted, approved, and built before. We see how those might fit on a piece of land, on a property, in a way that's livable and makes sense. We don't want to just jam, you know, bad things in just because it fits. So the first bucket would be pre-designed. The next is what we call pre-designed modified. So it's effectively taking the pre-designed designs and slightly modifying them to perhaps get more square feet because the property offers a bit more square feet, or maybe it's to add a balcony or a roof deck, something that adds an amenity that the pre-designed option doesn't have. So that's the second bucket, pre-designed modified. And then the third bucket would be custom, bespoke. You're starting, you know, kind of from scratch. You're trying to repeat things. Of course, you're repeating lessons learned, and you're using the same systems and the same, you know, consultants, engineers, all that. But you're effectively looking at a piece of land and trying to maximize every square foot of that land. And so, as I said, with any development deal, there's so many variables to consider. And it's really important for the ownership team to understand, like, what are the priority criteria, the priority variables that they want to go after, because there's pros and cons to each. We certainly bias ourselves towards things that are less bespoke. Housing is a great product type to repeat. You know, we've all lived in homes. We all know, like, how a bedroom is usually laid out with a bed and nightstand and a closet and things like that. So there's a lot of, you know, repeatability in housing that you wouldn't find in something else. You know, think to bench it with an extreme. If you think of a museum, there's all different types of rooms. Some are tall, some are short, and they're trying to create different spatial effects based on the art that's held in that museum. That's not repeatable. Housing is. So we feel as designers of housing that we should be engaging in that repeatable, like, element that's just inherent in housing.
Yeah, and can we talk a little bit about, in the three options, what is the timeline in each one, and really how much savings you can get as you go closer and closer to that fully pre-designed models?
So of those three buckets, pre-designed, pre-designed modified, and then custom, you're going to find that pre-designed is something that you could have plans prepared for permits submittal within 2 months, as short as even a month. You know, the variable that might increase it to 2 months or a little beyond that would be getting things that are specific to the site, like a survey from a licensed land surveyor or a geotechnical engineer to understand the soil. But absent those things creating any delays, the beauty of pre-designed is it could be submitted to the city within a month. I mean, even 2 weeks if things were just really dialed in, right? So you save time there, you save money, because say you go pre-design modified, you're going to spend at least an extra month to modify it correctly. It's going to require some new engineering,
yeah.
And that's going to take a minimum of one more month. So whereas pre-designed could be done in 1 to 2 months, pre-design modified is going to take you 3 to up to 4 months to properly modify it. And then of course custom, when you do custom, depending on the scale of the project, the complexity of the project, it could take anywhere from 4 to 10 months to submit. It really comes down to the complexity and the scale of the project.
Yeah, the complexity, the scale, and also the responsiveness of all the stakeholders in the project as well, right?
Absolutely,
like how fast are they getting the reviews done? How fast are the other consultants communicating with the rest of the consultants?
Yeah.
So you really save a lot of headaches when you go with a fully pre-designed, you know, because you mentioned that you need the geotechnical and the surveyor to make sure that that it fits in that lot with the proper setbacks and the soil requirements.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And if it does, you pretty much already have all your MEP design, your structural engineering, your civil.
Mm-hmm.
So am I missing any other of the service providers that must be included in the project?
So the biggest obstacle to building a project right now is connecting to utilities.
Yeah.
So building permits, you know, if you're working with a good design and engineering team, they should be able to get you through permitting in a reasonable timeline. The city can be slow and complicated, but that's what we do every day. We interface with them and we solve problems with them. Where it's difficult, ultimately, they're the most difficult, is really working with your utility provider. So here in San Diego, it would be San Diego Gas and Gas and Electric. So having someone on board, or just having your architect or your electrical engineer, or perhaps the owner is just more savvy in utility connections, but having them really like prioritize that is key to delivering any building on time.
Yeah, no, I agree. Like having a dry utility consultant engaged like as soon as you're submitting to the building department is like pretty much you must do that if you want to complete in a timely manner, because you know you'll get a permit, but then the electrics, San Diego and Gas and Electric Company will take another 6 months if you don't submit in the same timeline. So that's definitely the biggest delays we're seeing here in San Diego, and I think not just San Diego, but the rest of California has it the same. Definitely engaging in the very early stages in your project, it can be a very big time saver or difference maker for your project. Once you do your survey and you have your geotechnical study, maybe that like pre-designed model will not fit perfectly in that lot, and that's where you go for the pre-designed modified versions, right? To make those model modifications required to make it code compliant and that it works in that specific lot. Those are the time savings. Can we go a little bit on the cost savings? Is there any cost savings for going from the pre-design to the custom?
Oh yeah, absolutely. So from pre-design to custom, architects vary with what they deliver, but working with us, you're gonna find a pre-design model to be at least half the price of going full custom. The reality is it takes easily twice as much time and effort for my team to prepare custom as it does pre-designed. And in fact, it usually takes more like 4 times the amount of time.
Yeah.
So time is money. Everybody's got to get paid. So when you work pre-design, you're going to find that you're going to easily save 50% in terms of your costs. You're going to save at least 50% in your time. It easily cuts everything in half. And I think importantly to what you said about different stakeholders is when you choose pre-designed or even pre-designed modified, a beauty of it is you align everybody early in the process. And what I mean by that is everybody gets around a vision of what this building's going to be early on, as soon as day one, right? So if you came to me and you said, I like your pre-designed option number 3, we all know this is what you want. So whether that's 6, 10, or 12 months from now, that's like what you know you're going to be building, what you're going to see complete. When you work with custom, you're working for 3, 4, 5, 6, maybe even 8 months before everybody can see, say, a rendering of what the thing's going to look like. And that long, drawn-out process is great for certain buildings and types, but again, for housing, which can be repeatable, and we have such a housing shortage, so we want to build more of it quickly. Pre-design allows everybody to get aligned on what it's going to be, get excited about it, and create a lot of good momentum and energy in the project process. And you just see, like, you know, momentum, like, gets going, and people are excited to see it happen. There's nothing worse than taking 12 months to just know what the thing's going to be and then submit it to the city, right? Like, right. Yes, it's a journey, but when we're talking about housing and trying to deliver housing during a housing crisis, like, it's just important to know what you're going to get, like, as soon as possible.
100% agreed. And something that's also very important is, you know, having a very good architect as one of your stakeholders. Sometimes people really want to go for the lowest cost architect, and then, you know, they just get, once it gets to the permitting or even to the construction, all that cost savings they think they got for going for the cheaper architect becomes a much, much more costlier project. So by engaging with a very experienced architect, and local architect like yourself here in San Diego County that understands the code, that can help you navigate with building inspectors and plan reviewers, as well as help you like evaluate the feasibility of different bonus programs and incentives that could make your project have more units, more doors, make it a denser project, is very, very important at the end. So. Can we talk a little bit about your experience, you know, the different programs that we have here locally to help builders have denser projects with more doors per in the same lot?
Yeah. So the beauty of the city of San Diego is they've been at the forefront of housing policy for over a decade. A lot of the California state housing legislation that is passed originated in San Diego. Somebody saw that it was working in San Diego, so they took it to the state level and distributed it statewide. So here in the city of San Diego, we've got three main housing policies you'd want to consider for any urban infill lot that is going to be a housing project. So we'd like to think of that as small, medium, and large. So the small housing policy would be the ADU bonus program. The medium housing policy would be the affordable housing density bonus program, and then the large policy would be complete communities. Any of those programs could be a project that's small, medium, or large, but what we found over time is, smaller projects, or I should say the most financially viable smaller projects tend to use ADU bonus. The most financially viable projects that are large tend to use complete communities. So it's like when you consider all those different variables, that's the buckets more or less that they fall into. So the small project size ADU bonus is for us what we consider 8 to 20 units. It may demolish existing structures and start from scratch. It may keep, say, a home and build 8 units behind it, or 4 units behind it, or maybe even 20 units behind it. But the 4 to 20 unit range is what we call our small, and it works well with ADU bonus because there's many reasons, but the simplicity of the ADU bonus program is probably the most beautiful part about it. It's simply that if you want to add an additional unit to your property, you give one unit to moderate income affordable. So it means that one of your units becomes deed restricted as moderate income. And in return, you get one market rate unit back, a bonus. And then if you want to get another unit, you give one to affordable and you get one back. So it's a very simple logic. It's not like the traditional bureaucratic legislation where it's like, oh, I have to do this, this, and that. It's very simple. I give one, I get one, I give one, I get one. So there's a beauty in that in the ADU bonus. And I think because of its simplicity, because it's versatile for small lots that are 5 to 10,000 square feet, we've seen a lot of projects come to fruition in the city of San Diego. We've also seen the city of San Diego recognized with the Ivory Prize, which is a housing affordability prize that is nationwide. This school in Utah looks throughout the country for the best housing policies and the best ways that housing is becoming more affordable, and they award prizes every year. So the city of San Diego won that prize this year. So, you know, kudos to them for a great policy, and hopefully that means we're going to see it happen throughout the nation.
So in the focusing a little bit on the ADU bonus program, where you give one to a moderate income and then you get one, you're still limited to the FAR in that lot. So you can build as many as you want, as long as you're in the floor area ratio allowed in the zoning in your area. So that means that if you're allowed, you know, if you can fit 5 extra units, you can build 5 extra units. As long as, you know, you get 1 by right, then 2 that you would give to moderate income, and then 2 that you would get by a bonus at market rate. But really what we're seeing here in San Diego is that moderate income is very close to market rate in certain cases. Because when you do those moderate income or deed restricted units, you really get to choose of what AMI or average medium income tier you want to get those units rented out of. So you can get them like rented at deed restricted, but at 120% AMI, which is very close to what you would get market rate. Is that right?
Yeah, for the most part, that is right. So the moderate income unit that's deed restricted is deed restricted for 15 years rather than the traditional, what we call capital A affordable unit that's deed restricted for 55 years. So when you do an affordable housing project that has a 55-year deed restriction, everybody looks at that as a unit that doesn't provide value. It's just a cost. So a lender is going to look at that and just see it as a cost on your financial model. They're not gonna see it as returning value because it's deed restricted 55 years and the rent is quite low. But the ADU bonus program, another beautiful thing about it is it's not asking for the affordable unit to be above and beyond. It's looking for a mix that provides an affordable housing solution in what we call the missing middle, so moderate income. So there is some reduction that any owner would see in rents compared to market rate, but depending on the neighborhood you're in, it might be the same, it might be just a little lower. Certainly in higher resource areas, in coastal communities or nicer neighborhoods, if you were to do this in Little Italy, you would find that the rent is probably 15 to 20% lower. But if you're looking at a place in, say, North Park or say Normal Heights, you're going to find that the rent's probably pretty comparable. Mm-hmm. A key thing to keep in mind in the moderate income for ADU bonus, though, is you have the choice to either deed restrict the unit to 80% AMI for 10 years or deed restrict it to 110% AMI for 15 years. So that's just a math problem to do in the financial viability of it. You can look and say, well, do I want to get 110% rents for 15 years and then it goes to market rate? Or do I want to get 80% rents for 10 years and then it goes to market? And I think it's just becomes another one of those many variables any developer has to go through is this a neighborhood where I'd really like to have a market rate unit in 10 years because I think those rents will go up a lot in 10 years? Or do I want to choose 15 years because it might be a little slower for rental appreciation?
And a little bit going back to the pre-designed models and in the IDU bonus program, I know we designed these pre-designed models with the idea of incorporating them into the IDU bonus program. So can we talk a little bit about how many units and how many different pre-designed models you and your team have developed to be able to see if they're a good fit for a certain builder trying to build with the ADU bonus program?
So we have shifted our approach to pre-design to go beyond single family ADUs, like one unit, over the last year. And what we now have is a library of pre-designs that are anywhere from 4 to 50 units. and they can land in all different types of size lots, really anywhere. All of these units have been designed, engineered, and permitted, and many of them have gone through construction. So they've all been tested much more than any custom project you'd start from the beginning. You know, they've all gotten through permit approval at least, and many of them have completed construction. So currently in our library, we have over 35 that are, again, 4 to 50 units. We find that most of our library, the prototypes are like 8 to 20 units, because those are the types of projects we've just done most. It's a lot of ADU bonus projects or smaller affordable housing density bonus projects where they fit really well on lots that are 5 to 10,000 square feet. But the beauty of, say, working with us is when an owner has a lot that's 10,000 square feet, we can quickly test fit real designs that we've permitted on their property and say, well, we know that this 8-unit model can fit here. We know that this 12-unit model can fit here. We could take this 4-unit model and maybe make the units bigger and fit here, but we can have a much faster conversation to get to what's the highest and best use of the property.
And that's great on the design side, but I also think that it can give you some simplicity on, you know, the evaluation of the project on the construction side, because you are familiar with the actual cost of building one of these units, so takes away some of those change orders that might come when people start building.
Oh yeah.
So it gives a builder much more clarity on what their total project cost is going to be.
Right.
So if someone wanted to look at these designs or get a feasibility for their project, how can they reach out to you or see these designs so they can get a feasibility study for their project?
Yeah, I mean, the best way is to go to our website, which is paulo.us. Paulo.us. And you can get a good overview of what we do, how we approach projects, what the design philosophy is, as well as what is the housing strategies that we employ. You can reach out directly to me at david@paulo.us. You can give the office a call and find all that contact information on the website. But yeah, we're always taking calls and having conversations with repeat clients and new clients, all the time to test fit properties and see what can work. So every one of our projects begins with a feasibility study in what we would call a pre-design phase, where we work through 2 to 3 options to show what yields the best in terms of density, livability, and how it aligns with the owner's pro forma, and often we are also doing the pro forma. We can offer those services as well. But every project we think needs to be planned well. Even when it's pre-designed, you want to take some time to properly plan the project out, because as you've just said, Gabe, with change orders and things like that, a lot of times those things can be planned out of the project. There's no such thing as a perfect project, you know, from 0 to 100. But there are a lot of lessons learned, you know, from us and others, where you can avoid those surprise change orders that you've experienced in the past. So it's great to always plan a project out, spend that time to properly plan it out with the right team.
And I go back to the importance of having a good designer, not trying to save that extra money in the start of your project that's gonna cost you 4 or 5 times more at the time of construction.
Right.
So working with someone that you and your team that offer that pro forma, it's a great thing to have. Mm-hmm. Very few architects, designers offer that service.
Yep.
So definitely having a good designer, architect in your team can be a game changer for the project.
Yeah.
Something I would also like to talk about a little bit is how we have incorporated SIPs, Preflex structurally insulated panels, into some of these pre-designed models, mm-hmm. with the idea to optimize the SIPs to its optimal structural capabilities, to where clients can also get some cost savings during the construction time, as well as the time savings they'll get from the prefabricated standardized structural designs we have come up with. And yeah, talk a little bit about how we optimize in the construction side as well.
So we are We're a believer in SIPs and the construction method. I remember being in college over 20 years ago and being asked to do a report, a research project on a construction method that was kind of like alternative, and I chose SIPs. And so I have a long history of thinking on this, and I'm glad to see that Preflex is in the space doing SIPs and doing it where it can be local to San Diego County and Southern California, and even generally speaking, the Southwest. It can be really nimble and fast and work with builders all over those areas. So the projects we've designed specifically for SIPs and Preflex, they're mindful of that construction method. How do you make sure it gets delivered to site and it goes up fast and it interfaces with different trades on site? You know, a lot of that comes down to thinking of like your wet walls. How do you properly complement the SIPs technology with your wet walls for plumbing? But to your point on efficiency and spans, SIPs are like any construction method. You want a designer, an architect, an engineer who understands what its capacity is, so you can push that capacity and get the most out of it. So you want to know what the proper spans are. You want to know where you might have to put a purlin in or some other thing. You want to know what's the proper way to frame a roof so you're not complicating SIPs, because every construction method has its advantages. So you want to really know that construction method and take advantage of everything it's got. So with SIPs, beauty of it is, it at the end of the day, it's still panelized construction. It's not what we would call volumetric prefab, where it's three-dimensional. And panelized construction is great in our region because people are used to building with panels, right? They tilt up 2x4 walls and then they put a sheet of plywood. They put a panel of plywood on. So to go from that kind of wood frame construction to SIPs doesn't ask much. It's not getting complicated and complex like steel prefabricated volumetric units. It's something that is much easier for a general contractor, an owner, anyone to conceive of, because in the end it's a panel. And the key advantage of it is, rather than having to build the panel on site, it comes. It comes with the insulation. It comes with the finishes. It's ready to be a good exterior wall that's really efficient. And you know, in a time where everybody's really concerned about energy, it's probably the best cost to value exterior wall system you can get in terms of energy efficiency, and that creates just a better product, better thermal comfort for everybody.
Yeah, and I really want to emphasize that idea that SIPs really can be just like a back thought where you just change it at the time of construction. You really want to work with architects and engineers that understand the system and that optimize the design to get the most out of your package, where you actually get time and cost savings. Yeah. So I think that is very important, as well as, you know, the energy efficient factor, something that we haven't talked about, but I think it's important, is the upgrades that we're getting to Title 24 and how they're going to become stricter codes. And if you ever want to, you know, condomize your project to bring it up to the new Title 24 codes, if you had built it with SIPs, it would be easy for you to make the transition as it's already being compliant. Mm-hmm. But if not, there would be a lot of cost that can be like attributed to something like this of condomizing your project. Which is something I would like to talk a little bit about. You know, it's like a new program that we're seeing get more and more traction, where people are condomizing their ADU projects into actual condominium for sale products.
Yeah, that's a really great home ownership opportunity that the state passed an ADU law that went into effect January 1st of this year that allows ADUs to be conveyed separately, meaning they can be sold separately from the primary residence. That opens up a lot of this missing middle home ownership opportunity of, you know, homes that are anywhere from 500 to 1200 square feet. They're really great starter homes, good entry level homes. And to be able to properly either do a condominium conversion or, you know, build for it, you need to have a good construction system that is properly going to provide the sound ratings between units, the fire ratings between units. And you want a product that is built to last, right? You don't want the liability of poorly constructed stuff that's constructed on site and someone made an error because we're all humans, that then comes back and hurts you after you've sold that condo. So, you know, we like to think in the office or ask ourselves, how long is this building meant to last? We hope it's meant to last for a long time. A lot of projects are just simply not built to last these days. It's a lot of 2x4 wood frame construction on site with not the best waterproofing, not the best detailing, things like that. Using construction methods like SIPS is really pushing beyond the standard wood frame construction to provide something that's going to last much longer. So not only is it energy efficient on a day-to-day basis, it's also going to last longer because it's a better assembled product. And so to go back to your condo question, like when you're selling a project, you want to sell something that's going to last, that's going to be good. It's not going to come back with liability defects and warranties, costly kind of callbacks where you have to go back and fix something. So with ADUs now being able to be condominiumized, it's a great opportunity to look at SIPs.
Oh, yeah, I agree. And you bring up the missing middle a lot. And I think the ADU program, and one of the reasons San Diego got awarded the Ivory Award, is because it's been a very big issue in housing in California for a very long time. And I think the idea of coming up with the ADUs was to address this missing middle housing, which, you know, there is a lot of single family homes and there is very big skyscrapers, but where is this housing type that is mm-hmm. that we don't mm-hmm. have, the missing yep. middle? Yep. So how do you see, like, the IDU program has been working now for, over 5 years?
About 4 years now. 4 years. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So have you seen that the city and the state are properly addressing, and we're adding more inventory of this missing middle housing? Are we really addressing the problem, or is there anything else that you think the city or the homeowners can do mm-hmm. to address the missing middle?
There's always more to do, but I do want to give, you know, kudos where it's deserved. I think the housing policies that the city of San Diego have put together really have, like, incentivized and increased housing production here in San Diego. To go back to utilities and utility companies, that's where I think cities should be forming stronger relationships with their utility provider to make it simpler for the owner, the builder, developer to, you know, take permanent plans from the city and make sure they get their utilities connected. There's still a gap in communication between those two parties. And unfortunately, an individual builder just doesn't have the power, the money, the resources to go to a utility company and get them to improve how they do things. But jurisdictions like City of San Diego and you know, City of Los Angeles, all these cities are having this problem with utility companies. They have a bigger pool of resources and, you know, more powerful figures who could engage utility companies and really promote partnerships that streamline and simplify the process for energizing missing middle housing. Missing middle housing is difficult to pencil, to make financially viable, if utilities aren't properly managed. It's very easy for, say, an 8-unit project to no longer be feasible because something with utilities and the upgrading of those utilities increase the cost, you know, so much that it's just no longer viable. So that's where I think we need, you know, the city as well as the state to step in and find new methods for making utility connections simpler. So housing policy, I think, has been really improved over the past years. Utilities are where I think the next big, you know, fight should be. And then I'd add on to that, there's building code reform that we could do that could simplify missing middle housing. There's things like legalizing single stairs beyond 3 stories. So that's something that's gotten a lot of traction throughout the country. We've seen different states and cities throughout the U.S. increase the number of stories that one stair can serve. Throughout the U.S., only a single stair can only serve up to 3 stories with 4 units per floor. that is much different than the rest of the world. Developed countries all over the world allow single-stair buildings to go up to 6 stories, 10 stories, 20 stories. There's even countries where it's unlimited. Switzerland allows a single stair to serve an unlimited amount of stories. So all of these countries that are developed countries that have strict building codes themselves have found ways to look at how do we construct things to be just as safe, but only use one stair. And I bring that up because when you're talking about missing middle housing, you have really restricted area to build.
Exactly.
So as soon as you have to do that one extra stair, or as soon as you have to do, I don't know, an extra storage closet because the local planning department wants a storage closet, it makes it hard to build that. You're working with really tight space. It's Tetris, it's Jenga, whatever you want to call it, but you're fighting for every square foot to make a really livable unit for people. So there are building code reforms that could also be done in addition to utilities, but I feel that at least at our local level, City of San Diego, the housing policies are quite good. And yeah, they can be improved like incrementally, but where we should be focusing our efforts as an industry is how do we improve the utility process and how do we get building code to look at other means to provide the same level of life safety.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought you bring up on the stairs. Definitely something that could be addressed and could help these projects become more feasible because it's also, well, it reduces the amount of rentable square footage, but it also increases the cost of the building by a lot.
Yeah.
So.
And I'll add that a single stair building is also qualitatively nicer. You know, they're typically the kind of building where there's a stair in a courtyard that's open to the sky with fresh air and people's doors look onto that shared stair. So it becomes more of a community, becomes more of its own little kind of semi-private, semi-public enclave where neighbors know each other. When you think of the traditional two-stair building, it's a long corridor like a hotel where there's a stair on one end of the building and a stair on the other end of the building, that per code, that those stairs could be like a football field apart. And it's doors to units on both sides, it's dark, it's just not good qualitative space. Single stair buildings are nicer buildings. They also allow us to design and build more family units. A single stair prototype building simply makes it easier to provide bedroom egress windows for larger units. Whereas a double loaded corridor, two stair building, it is very difficult to create those types of family units and do those units in a safe way.
Oh, and you bring up a very good point on the importance of design, right? We want to increase the density, but the design is still very important because we want to have, you know, beautiful neighborhoods where we have nice buildings. So it is very, very important we keep a very high standards within the design of this missing middle housing.
Absolutely.
And we hope like other cities around California follow San Diego's lead in pushing different bonus program incentives to really address the missing middle problem, have statewide, maybe beyond statewide, but nationwide in some areas. So I'm very proud to like be here in San Diego where they are like the pioneers in these ideas, and I really hope it expands. I think we are coming to the end of the show. I really appreciate you sharing all your thoughts with me and all of our listeners. I think you bring up really good and strong points. I don't know if you have any closing thoughts.
I would just emphasize the importance of creating quality housing. There's been a lot of fight to increase housing, the quantity of housing, and I think those housing policies within City of San Diego really are addressing quantity, and I'd like us all to reorient ourselves around what is quality housing. And I think this isn't just a design thing, it's also a business decision. As more units go out on the market, developers are competing against each other, and the building that has a higher quality product is simply going to be rented or sold easier. So it's becoming harder for a developer to put out bad buildings, bad units. So I just want to seed that in everybody's ear to really focus on quality. Let's make good housing. You know, housing is something for everybody. Everybody deserves to be in a home. And the quantitative fight of increasing housing, we have the right mechanism to do that. Now let's focus on quality housing.
Thank you, David. Thank you for listening to today's episode. Please go follow us on our social media, and we look forward to seeing you in our next episode.